You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people who make them and do not necessarily represent the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or any of its affiliates or advertisers. Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth, thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. Now, for those of you who are joining us for the very first time, welcome aboard. We're glad to have you. And you need to know that we have a free weekly newsletter, and you can subscribe to that. It's called the K-Files e-zine. You can subscribe to that by going over to the website, kevinsmithshow.com, and just subscribe. There you'll be, all right? Now, I got an email that I want to read to you. That email is from one of our listeners, and here is what it says. It says, "Kevin, hi, Kevin. I was hesitant to send this mailing to you because I'm afraid you'll think I'm either crazy or lying to you. Maybe it's nothing, but I can't get it off my mind." Let me start here first. I was not a viewer of Meet the Press and only saw Tim Russert a few times during campaign coverage on television. Well, one night I had a restless night, and for whatever reason, every time I awoke, Mr. Russert would enter my mind. I fell back asleep again and dreamed about him. Well, as you probably guessed by now, when I awoke the next morning, I heard the news that Mr. Russert had passed away. I thought it odd he was on my mind, and then hearing this news about him. He says, "But there's something that happened to me this past Sunday that I cannot dismiss or understand. I was surfing the net, and on MSN homepage, I saw the final score of the Eagles-Cowboys NFL game. This was approximately 6 p.m. Eastern time. The game wasn't supposed to start until 8:30 p.m., and I figured that they played the game earlier for whatever reason. Well, around 9:30, I put the TV on and saw that the Eagles-Cowboys game was on and was only in the second quarter. The final score was exactly as I saw it on MSN homepage 2.5 hours before the game even started. I swear to you that I'm telling you that what I'm telling you is the truth, and I can't get it off my mind. Have you any idea how this could happen or what it may mean? I never believed in psychic stuff, so I kind of don't even want to consider that, but please, if you have any ideas, how could this happen or what it all means, please let me know." Okay, yes, it is possible that you have experienced a precognition. It is possible, but it's also a possibility. I know this is way out there, but it's a possibility that you experience sort of a time slippage, where you, for whatever reason and by whatever means, were transported forward in time momentarily so that you were seeing the score at the final score, but you were seeing it before the game had even started. I really don't know what happened, but I, you know, those are some of the things that people have talked about here on this show. And I would say that It's not anything to be afraid of, but it is rather amazing. It is rather amazing. Now, if you see the outcome of the next Super Bowl or something, you be sure and let me know. I'd like to know that. All right, we'll be back right after this. My guest this evening is Glenn Kimball. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I am Kevin Smith, your host, and my guest this evening is Glenn Kimball. And I am absolutely delighted that he is with us because he always brings to us something, well, it's always interesting, but it is also always controversial. Now, I just want to say before we get into all of this interesting and I hope controversial information with Glenn Kimball, I want to say for all of you who are new to the show, if hearing something that challenges what you already believe bothers you, this is not the show for you. If you if it bothers you, if it upsets you, if it gets you all churned up and torqued that someone has a different opinion, this is not the show for you. I would recommend that you listen to a show that maybe a Marxist show a full-blown communist hardcore show where everyone is expected to, you know, think in lockstep. But if you like having the opportunity to hear new material, things that you haven't thought about before, perceptions, perspectives, opinions that you haven't thought about, then this is the show for you because we do examine a lot of stuff that's sort of alternative. It's out there on the edge. And who put it out there on the edge? That's a good question. Who determined that it was going to be out there on the edge? Well, we might talk about that just a little bit. Glenn, welcome back to the show.
It's always good to be with you, Kevin.
Glenn, you've just returned from a meeting up at James Gilliland's retreat up at near Mount Adams, right?
Yeah, well, that's correct. Just got back.
I had an opportunity, folks, to talk with Glenn a little bit today, so I happen to know that there's something interesting and amazing that happened there. So, Glenn, would you share that with us?
Sure. James Gilliland is a good old friend. And I'm not a ufologist in the sense that, if I can say it this way, and there will probably be people that disagree with me, but ufology is almost like a religion now, where people will encapsulate you. You either are a believer or you're not a believer.
Yeah, I'm not a believer.
And so it's encapsulated in this package we call ufology, and things that are outside that package are things that people would object to. And I think myself, over the years, I've been an outsider. I've been an outsider in the sense that I think that the majority of the experiences that people have at least reported have been for their own special interests. and that's, you know, that's to be understood. You know, even talking to my own wife, she always expresses her opinion to aggrandize herself, you know.
I'm not going to get into that.
So she's in the other room, so I'm still safe. There's been no bloodshed here. but the point of the issue is that we were up at James Gilliland's ranch, and I put out a note and invited everyone to come up with us. It was over the Labor Day weekend, and I postulated that what if we actually saw a UFO? How amazing that might be. And I probably said that with tongue-in-cheek. I shouldn't have said it with tongue-in-cheek. because I saw something that is on my weirdo meter right at the very top. We were out.
And let me say this, because, I think you'll understand the perspective, the angle that I'm taking here. When you say that something is on your weirdo meter, it really is strange, because you deal with and talk about things that, as I said, are way out there on the edge, and we're going to talk about a little bit tonight who put them out there on the edge, who decided that that was out on the edge, and we'll talk about that a little bit. But
I found out years ago, Kevin, that the strangest things are always things that are true. Truth is always stranger than fiction.
Yeah,
and part of the adventurous part of me that has encountered the strange and the weird has been right inside the public library system with my library card.
Mm-hmm.
And I apologize to people who think that what I say might be controversial, but I can promise you one thing: that everything that I've said and everything that I do say, you can find in your public library system. And, you know, I've called my website ancientmanuscripts.com. I've changed the name to thekimballcollege.com. But every single thing I have said has been reported not in just in one single manuscript, but in multiple manuscripts.
Yeah, we'll get to all of that in a moment. I want to hear about this UFO.
Yeah, this UFO, we were out the first night we were there. He had a new piece of camera equipment, which was infrared camera equipment. It wasn't just an infrared still shot. It was an infrared motion picture camera equipment. And it was high-tech. It was very nice.
Mm-hmm.
I saw all the orb things, which are, as far as I'm concerned, are still undetermined. I, in my head, I'm thinking this is a problem with his system, you know. We saw all kinds of space debris going overhead, and there were people, the crowd that was there were saying, oh, that's a UFO, and in my mind I'm thinking, no, that's space debris. You know, there's over a million pieces of space debris in our atmosphere and going over our heads all the time. I saw meteors come down. The sky was beautiful. We didn't have one day of rain in Washington State. Now, that's very high on my Wordle meter right there.
Yeah, it is.
But I was standing there behaving myself, trying to keep warm, even though it was it's summertime, so it's technically there. And my son said, "Dad, raise your head, look at this right now." And I didn't pay any attention to him. I had my son with me. He says, "No, Dad, this is something you got to look at right now." And I raised my head up, and I saw coming along the horizon a triangular object that I cannot explain, and it was in my view for not just for a couple of seconds. This was in my view for minutes at a time. I can't really tell you how many minutes. If I were to guess, I would say probably 10 minutes. This thing was in my view. Though when you're in a state of shock, you don't know, you know. This thing was very high up in the atmosphere, but it was very, very, very large. It covered the entire top of Mount Adams, and my best guesstimate of size would be that it was well over a mile in diameter.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about. So you're saying that this thing was like a mile across from wingtip to wingtip?
More than a mile across, because it extended over the entire mountain of Mount Adams. It was perfect triangular in nature, didn't deviate at all. It had the lights for folks on the corners. It was triangular in shape. It moved very slowly across the horizon all the way to my right. And it got around to the right, and I was transfixed. I mean, I was looking at this thing not through his camera. I was looking at this thing with my naked eyeballs.
And now this was at nighttime?
It was It was after dark, but it was early in the evening, so I would guesstimate it was somewhere around 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night when we saw it. The sun had gone down, but there, like I said, the sky didn't have a cloud in the sky. Or if it had a cloud, it was a teeny-weeny one toward the Seattle direction, and this triangular object was in the opposite direction.
Now, where is this ranch in relationship to Seattle?
Well, Seattle is in the northern part, northwestern corner.
Mm-hmm.
This ranch is right off the Columbia River on the south side of Washington State near White Salmon.
So Seattle is northwest of the ranch?
Yes, it is.
Uh-huh.
It takes you about, if the traffic's heavy, probably three hours to get to Seattle from his ranch. So we're talking about some distance here.
So whenever this triangular UFO left, it was headed toward Seattle?
It was headed away from Seattle.
Away from Seattle.
Yeah, it was headed from Mount Adams toward Mount Hood.
Okay. Now, you were not by yourself. It was not just you and your son. It wasn't just you, your son, and James Gilliland. There were some other people there, right?
Oh, there was an entire crowd. I would guesstimate there were somewhere around 100 people out watching this thing, all commenting, all looking in the same direction, all seeing the same thing, all talking about the same thing. We had the advantage of being able to look through his camera monitor, which magnified the intensity of the object about three or four times, but you could also see it very clearly with your naked eye. So the thing on the camera was very, very clear, distinct, but the one you could see with your naked eyes was just as clear and just as distinct. It just wasn't as magnified as heavily.
What color was it?
What color?
Yeah.
You're talking to a man who's colorblind. How the heck do I know?
You know, I forgot about that.
I
forgot.
No clue.
Did anybody tell you what color it was?
No, I never did ask that question. All I know is that I began the process that goes through my head is the same discovery process that would go through any scientist's head, and I count myself a scientist par excellence. I began running through the alternatives of what this might be, like a formation of jet aircraft or larger, any kind of an aircraft. It was not that. It wasn't swamp gas. It wasn't flares dropping from the sky like they saw down here in Phoenix.
I don't think they saw flares dropping from the sky until after the real event had already happened.
Yeah, and I don't know. I wasn't here. I got here about, I moved to Arizona, to Phoenix, Arizona, just after that event took place. So I never saw it with my own eyes.
Yeah, but I didn't either, but I have seen the video, several videos taken by several different people of the Phoenix lights, and I'm telling you there is no way that those are flares. Now, later, they did drop flares and then used that as the cover story and said, oh, well, yeah, we dropped flares. Well, when you look at videos of those flares, you're looking at them and you're saying, yeah, that's flares. Yeah, that looks like flares.
Well, that's something that I've never sat down and postulated in my head,
mm-hmm.
veracity of the Arizona lights.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not something that I ran through the whole gamut of the protocol of the things that it might or might not have been. Though I've seen many of the same videos, I probably haven't seen anywhere near as many as you.
One thing, though, this thing that you were looking at Mount Adams up in that area,
mm-hmm.
if that had been flares, one of the things you would have seen would have seen little parachutes up above the flares. You would have seen them swaying in the breeze, and you would have seen a trail of smoke ascending upward as the flares burn. Did you see any of that?
Absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, this was at such a distance from us that you would not have seen a flare in any case. This was at least 25 to 30 miles away,
mm-hmm.
but it was up high enough in the sky to where you were actually looking at the underbelly of this vehicle. I'm not trying to tell you that it came up right over my head, because that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
It was, my son says it was in the ionosphere. He's a scientist as too, but I don't know whether it was in the ionosphere or not, if it was that high or not, but it was at an extreme altitude, not where you would drop flares,
mm-hmm.
not where flares would burn, not where a conventional aircraft would be flying either, conventional aircraft being at 35,000 feet, maybe as high as 40,000 feet in extreme cases. This was higher than that, much higher than that.
What you said, it was triangular. Now, you told me this afternoon about when this thing left, some strange thing occurred, the way it left and the lights on it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the way it left was totally bizarre. The lights in the front and the lights in the back began to move toward each other. Now, this happened very rapidly. It didn't happen instantaneously, but it only took maybe a second, and a second's a very long time, by the way, if you watch it. This probably took 2.5 seconds to do. The lights from the front and the lights from the back converged all into one pinpoint and then vanished. And in my mind, I'm thinking, well, whatever this was took off in the absolute 180-degree opposite direction from me at some super rate of speed, and then that possibility disappeared from my head, and I thought, no, that's not possible either, because it was at such a distance that I would have seen it exit our view for a lot longer than 2.5 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
But this thing, what it looked like, I had the impression that it was going through a portal of some sort.
So it's just there 1 minute, 1 second, and then the next it's gone.
The lights on the edge of the vehicle collapsed into one pinpoint of light and then vanished from sight. And you asked me what I think that was. I don't know. Could it have been terrestrial in origin? Well, it could have been. If we have an experimental aircraft that's over a mile in diameter, which I don't think it does exist.
At least not any that we know about.
Not any that I know about. Not any I've ever heard of. And if it were a mile in diameter, it would have been moving at a higher velocity to maintain its altitude. This thing was not moving quickly.
Mm-hmm.
This thing was moving at a very slow and cumbersome, methodic, plodding type of motion, floating across the sky. This was not going with the wind. This was going against the prevailing wind. The wind. There was a wind of about 10 to 15 miles an hour. It was going against that predominant velocity. I know because I looked at the Doppler photographs, and it was going against that particular direction of the wind currents.
All right, we have to take a break, and if you'll hang on, we'll be back right after this. Don't go away, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I am Kevin Smith, your host, and my guest this evening is Glenn Kimball. Now, Glenn, this was a very amazing thing for you. I mean, it had an effect on you, didn't it?
Well, it does. Even though I have seen weird and strange things across the world, all the way from Egypt into the Amazon jungle, I thought I'd exhausted my limit when I sat with the natives in the Amazon jungle, and they sat at their campfires and called their ancestors out of the hills. And that experience, after they began calling their ancestors out of the hills, something that you probably would say not on your top 10 things you want to ever see again.
Well, why do you think? Because you're here in the United States, hearing about UFOs and seeing videos and pictures and TV documentaries about these things, why do you think it had that effect on you?
I had my son with me, first of all, and, you know, to actually have shared something with my son, I had an experience. May I tell you another experience?
Yeah.
I had dated a young lady who only had one leg.
Okay.
One-legged lady story.
Mm-hmm.
She had cancer, and I had compassion on this woman. We had planned this for me to share her death with her, and she couldn't live in my home. It's against my moral code to just have her live there. So we'd planned to get married and have a Celtic priest, you know, on Halloween marry us, and then she would move in and I would help her through the grieving, dying process. Getting close to Halloween, she had come across an old high school sweetheart that stepped up and said that he wanted to help her through the death process, and I graciously bowed out and said, "Go right ahead." But I felt, you know, sad because we already planned this big druid wedding up in the mountains, you know, just for the heck of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And but I held this party, this Halloween party, in a place where it was packed. There were hundreds of people there. And I was the guest host. And one of the people that I had hired, I didn't know very well. And she, come to find out, was a druid priestess. And she said, "I know you feel sad today." She was dressed up like a witch, and she was about 6'3". She was a lot bigger than I was. And she said, "I have a way to stop you from grieving." And I was hoping that I didn't show the grieving process, but it must have been on my face. And I said, what do you have in mind? She says, "Well, let's go up and see the fairies." And I went, "What? Go up and see the what?" She says, I want to take you up there. They'll make you happy." And I thought to myself, well, you know, you've seen every other bizarre thing in the universe. You might as well go see the freaking fairies, you know. And we drove up into the hills, up into the Uinta Basin mountains. And on our way up, we got out at a particular rest stop. And she said, "Now face the side of the hill across the road there," which was about a mile. And no, probably 200 or 300 yards. That's fair. And she says, "And I'm going to stand behind you and call the fairies out of the trees." And I said, "Right."
So at this point, did you think she had been standing a little bit too close to the punch bowl?
I figured that she had stood close to it. I know I hadn't, because I was the host and I hadn't drank a drop.
And I am
the enemy of hallucinogenic drugs, for reasons beyond the scope of this program. But anyway, she gets behind me, and she says, "Okay, now look now." And I looked up in the trees, and all of a sudden, I saw tens of thousands of these flying little fairy-like creatures dodging in and out of the trees. And we were up above there are no fireflies in these mountains.
Yeah.
Nothing. I mean, there's nothing that could be presumed. But I saw these things, and she said, and I was astonished. I started backing up, and I ran right into her. She says, "Hold on a minute, stand right there." She says, "Do you want me to make them leave?" And I said, "No." I said, "I'll only see this once in my life."
Mm-hmm.
But to make a long story short, I watched these things for about a half an hour. It was a delight. I had fun. We went home, and I thought, well, I've just hallucinated something that was just made me feel better.
Mm-hmm.
But I told my best friend about it. I said, "You're not going to believe what I saw." And he said, "Well, take me up and show me." And I said, "Well, I can't, you know, I'll take you up there, but I can't guarantee anything." But we went back up there, and these silly little lights with wings on them were flying all through the trees. And
so he saw them too.
Yeah, he saw them too.
Uh-huh.
And it was the same. It was the second time I saw them that really had the effect on me. And you asked me the question, how come I was so affected by this? When I see it on my own and I do it on my own, I'm not done with the process of trying to explain away the phenomena.
Uh-huh.
And so it really doesn't astonish me as much as it does when someone you really know and trust shares an experience with you. You know,
mm-hmm.
The same thing with my wife when we got married. The night we got married, we were in the 10th floor of the Disneyland Hotel. And she had heard me talk about these experiences all during our whole several years of courtship, but she had never seen anything. And in through the door about 1:30 in the morning, a man walked through and sat on the edge of our bed, and the bed crunched down. I mean, he was there, okay. And I thought, I wish my wife this. And I leaned over to her and I woke her up and I said, do you see what I see? And she says, oh my goodness, it's my daddy. Her daddy had been dead for 5 years.
Uh-huh.
And he sat and talked with us. Now, sharing that experience with my wife was a lot more of an impact to me than having the experience on my own and once again begin running through the scenario of what could have that have been. Was I really dreaming? Was I hallucinating?
Well, yeah, and when you've got someone there with you, you've got sort of an anchor that sort of anchors it down and says, no, this is not a hallucination. Someone else saw this too.
That's the point that I'm trying to make, is that when you share these kinds of experiences with somebody else, realize that it's not you having a flashback from the 60s at Haight-Ashbury, you know.
I've been hoping to have some flashbacks. I'd like to just sort of have some flashbacks to back when I had hair.
You know?
People look at
I've
me
never
now.
Had a flashback, but I've heard of them, and not that I wasn't committed to the Haight-Ashbury mentality and crowd. I mean, I've met David Crosby, Jim Morrison, and the whole crowd, and we partied together and did our thing, you know. But I've never really had a flashback.
I'd like to sort of move us forward, I'm moving us backward. I wanted to hear about that very large UFO that you saw, because when you told me about it, instantly I said, now this is something that the Kevin Smith Show family would love to hear about. But, you know, there's something else really large that we talked about. And I think right now, at this particular point in time, this particular point in history, I think it's important for us to talk about it. And that is an ancient story, an old story, of an explorer who witnessed Native Americans with what today we call a Bigfoot. But I want to tell you why I think it's important, and then I want us to talk about it. I think it's important because of this whole fiasco that just took place where you had Tom Biscardi going on TV and calling a national press conference and saying, you know, we have found these guys from Georgia have found the body of a Bigfoot, and I can assure you that what I have seen, what I've touched, what I've prodded, what I felt, and what I smelt was not a monkey mask on a bear skin. And, you know, and then it turned out to be not a monkey mask on a bear skin, but just as bad. It was all a hoax. And so a lot of people throw the baby out with the bathwater. And they say, see, there is no Bigfoot. Well, that one event simply shows you that that was not a Bigfoot, but do they exist? Now, you've done a little research on this, and you, in fact, have a letter or a copy of the letter that was written by this explorer to a monarch. And
that's absolutely right.
We can just get started with this, and then we'll hit a break, and then we'll come back and continue. But tell us about this.
Well, Christopher Columbus had two different kinds of writing. He had his diaries, which were very piecemealed, very difficult to understand because they were just like anybody else's diaries. They were daily entries that were never intended to be read from front to back. But the letter that he wrote to Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand contained the story of his actually seeing and witnessing the Native American Indians on his second voyage kill a Bigfoot, chop it into pieces because they couldn't haul it away, and carry it off. It was not an ape because it had the face of a human being. It had a human-like hands, and it moved in an upright fashion, unlike the monkeys that were in the trees in the Caribbean. And they had shot it, killed it, and
now they shot it, I am presuming, with bows and arrows.
With a bow and arrow,
mm-hmm.
Correct. They shot it with a bow and arrow. We could talk all about the details of that bow and arrow, but the fact remains that Christopher Columbus saw that, and he reported it. He witnessed it with his eyeballs. He saw it. He saw them remove it. His men saw it being removed.
Okay, we have to take a break. Folks, we'll be back right after this. Don't go away. All right, welcome back. We are talking with Glenn Kimball this evening. Glenn, before we went away for break, you were telling us about Christopher Columbus, and that he had written this letter back to Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand, and that in this letter he described seeing with his own eyes Native Americans in the Caribbean who shot with a bow and arrow and killed what today we call a Bigfoot.
That's correct.
How did he describe it? How did he describe this creature?
Said the creature was about 9.5 feet tall. Said it was too heavy for them to carry off. The people who actually shot this creature were cannibals. So they wanted the meat from this particular creature, and they cut off his arm and cut off one of his legs in order for them to be able to lift him. And transporting back to their village.
Now, did he?
That's not describing a monkey.
Yeah. did he describe this creature as being hairy? And if so, did he say what color it was?
Yeah. He obviously said it was covered from head to foot with hair, all the way on its face, all the way down to its hands and its feet. His face were all covered with hair. But that the expression and the facial features of the creature were humanoid. They were not monkey. You know, a monkey has a very flat nasal cavity and some distinct characteristics that would make him appear to be simian in nature. What he saw, he said, was a human being that was 9 foot tall, covered with hair, and too heavy for the cannibals to cart off. So they had to cut him up in pieces to carry him off. And, you know, that's just one event.
Mm-hmm.
The ape people who populated the planet is an old story that comes out in textual format in books like The Cave of the Treasures that was originally written in Sanskrit and then in Arabic, and then over the years has been translated into English, and you can find it in a public library system. The thing that I'm famous for is for finding these documents people can have access to if they really care to.
Well, yeah, and that's an important point. But I think it's also important. I don't want us to leave this story about Christopher Columbus without making this point. I am not, and I think you know me. We've met personally, and you're familiar with my stance on things. I said early in this show, when we're talking about UFOs, I'm not a believer. I'm not a disbeliever either. They either exist or they don't. And for me, it's just that simple. Either it's real or it's not. With this thing about Bigfoot, I'm in the same boat. I'm not a believer. I'm not a disbeliever. Either they exist or they don't. I find it rather difficult to sit in a country, this side of the world, having been discovered, as far as the Europeans are concerned, by Christopher Columbus. He discovered it. People took his word for it. And I know about the whole debate, folks, about, you know, somebody else discovered it before Chris did, but, you know, okay. Be that as it may, nations took his word that he had discovered this, and they loaded up boats full of explorers and sent them over here based on his testimony. And they found that he was correct. Now, I find it very difficult to say that we're not going to buy or believe his story about this creature. We bought and believed his story about the New World. And sure enough, here it is, and we're sitting in it. Or I am. You are, Glenn. So here we are. And he also says that he saw this creature. I think it's a bit difficult to justify not buying that story, too.
Well, I think it's illustrative of the fact of how we record history. We keep what we like to believe in, and we discard the rest.
Mm-hmm.
That has happened to the point where I'm famous for saying that we live in the dark ages of history. We live in the dark ages of our own science. We live in the dark ages of religion because we've allowed those processes to take place over so many years untouched, unfettered. No one's fettered out the truth, and we've allowed ourselves to separate out the parts we like and to discard the pieces that we don't like, to the point where we are completely in the dark of what really has gone on in history. That's why truth is always stranger than fiction. We live in the days when we have manufactured our own reality of what exists and what doesn't exist. There are people on this planet who are listening to this show who will believe in UFOs but will not believe in Bigfoot. And that there are people on the listen to the show that believe in Bigfoot, believe in UFOs, but won't believe in other kinds of phenomena like...
Well, like the fairy folk that you talked about.
Like the fairy folks that mm-hmm. we talked about. Or in God, for example. I mean, God's completely been discounted off the table.
This is a good point to discuss that question that I said we would discuss at some point. And that is the question of who has decided, who is it that decides what's going to be the information that gets moved out to the edge and becomes anomalous information? I mean, let's say this event here that Christopher Columbus has described, that doesn't go in the history books. Who decides that that's edge information and they scoot it out to the side and they don't include that in the history books? Who decides that?
Well, I think we've developed a society that feels themselves to be powerful enough and arrogant enough to decide what's real and what is not real. And I find that to be very disconcerting. I feel it disconcerting to send all of our kids to colleges and have them learn from people with great big titles behind their name what they believe is true and what's not true, only to have them come away and realize that the vast majority of what they've been taught in college is just is just a piece of a larger iceberg that somebody in power has excluded from the story. And we have allowed ourselves as students who have gone to college like myself to believe that our professors are telling us most of the truth. And the reality is we live in the dark ages and they tell us much less than most of the truth. They only teach us a fragment of what is true. And someday...
Well, you know, that I'm not a religious person, but that brings up a statement that was made that is so apropos, it fits so well with what you just said. A statement that was made by Jesus in the New Testament, and he's talking to a bunch of religious leaders, and he says, "Beware lest the light that is in you be dark."
Yeah.
And so here you've got people going to university thinking they're getting light, being taught that it is light, and you're saying, no, it's really dark.
That's correct. And he also said, have eyes to see and ears to hear, and stop trying to make up your own mind, your own reality. We have to be consummate students in order to be able to find out what reality really is.
Well, we live in a society, well, we've got a break coming up here in just a minute, but we live in a society that has bought, a whole bunch of folks have bought the idea that we create our own reality. But the fact is, if you believe that you create your own reality, you are doomed to live in fiction land.
And you're doomed to live in the reality you created.
Yeah, the real problem is that you can convince yourself that what you have constructed in your mind is reality. But reality is objective, and it stands out there and faces us all. And, you know, sometimes you end up running into it like it's a brick wall, and it's a bit destructive.
And we all are shocked, even we who have more open minds than most, and I pride myself in that, even I get shocked when I see giant spacecraft flying through the air at James Gilliland's ranch.
If you've never seen one, yeah, that would be shocking if you've never seen one. The thing, though, about this thing about creating our own reality is really important. More so than people realize, when you live in fiction land, you end up with what we've got happening on Wall Street today. Reality is reality, whether we like it or don't like it. And you can live in fiction land only for so long, and then reality steps in. All right, we have to take a break. We will be back right after this with Glenn Kimball. All right, we are back, and this is the Kevin Smith Show for those of you who have just accidentally stumbled into our studio, and I'm Kevin Smith, your host. We are talking with Glenn Kimball, and we will, in just a few minutes, open up the telephone lines for you. At the moment, they are not open. And it'll be just a few minutes before we decide to open them. So hang in there, all right? Now, Glenn, when we went away for break, we were talking about this whole thing of reality and people thinking that they can create their own reality. The fact is, we can create an environment around us based upon our perceptions of reality, that we can do. But there are certain things out there that are just there, and they are facts, and they are immovable, and if we deny that they are real, then we end up running into them like a brick wall, and we have problems. Would you put... I mean, you've read this story about, it's not a story, but it's an account by Christopher Columbus in his report to the Queen and King of Spain. How much stock do you put in that report? Would you say it's a reality?
I would say that the document is 100% real. I can tell you that to the best of his, that it's 100% sure that to the best of his ability, he was trying to describe what he saw with his eyes. Now, what actually happened on that day, we weren't there. I think we would probably be freaked if we were. One of the things that I like to tell people is that manuscripts are a lot better than trying to use the shape of a pot when you go to an archaeological site. What scientists have reduced themselves to is that the first thing they do is to look at the shape of the pots at a brand new archaeological dig. And they try and tell the story based on the shape of the pots. They try to give a date when it was first opened, the day when the people were there, something about the culture. And my comment is, why don't you read what the people wrote, for goodness sake?
Yeah, if it's available. If it's available.
That's become a secondary issue.
All right, now, when you read this letter that Christopher Columbus wrote, Does he say how many of his men were with him that also saw this, or was he by himself?
Oh, no, he was with everybody that was on his ship, and his ships had 60 people on them at a time. So there was at least 50 or 60 people who saw this thing.
All right, do we know what island this was on?
We do not know. I do not know.
Uh-huh.
I think that we could do it by a process of elimination. He talked about thousands of islands in the Caribbean, and there are thousands of islands in the Caribbean. And he had nicknames for a lot of them, San Salvador, Hispaniola, Juana. Juana was, in fact, another name for Florida.
Yeah. Hispaniola, well, and Hispaniola was what, Jamaica?
Hispaniola, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Jamaica.
Yeah, that's it's what we call Jamaica today.
That's right. There were many times when he saw four or five islands at the same time, and he gave them nicknames. The Indians had names for them all, and so we're not entirely certain which one it was, but I'll guarantee you one thing, it wasn't the great ape from South Africa that was on any of these islands.
Well, could it have been, do you think, since he had a name for Florida? Could it have been what they call the skunk ape in Florida?
Could easily have been the skunk ape from Florida. And there were other things that happened to him. You know, he, for example, on one occasion when he was reporting back to Queen Isabella, he said he found a group of men who had beards on them that were wearing Western clothing that were dead on a riverbank. Now, who were those guys? They weren't people that he had left there. They weren't people that he had left to build a city there. They were people who were obviously doing exploration there before he got there. Who were those people? They weren't Native American Indians, because Native American Indians, 100% of the tribes in the Caribbean were beardless. And, by the way, most of the Indian tribes that he met in the Caribbean, when he looked at their vestments and he was just looking at their clothing,
yeah,
they had a turban, they wore button-down sleeve shirts, and pants.
Wow!
But that's not the feathers and the...
No, that's not the image that we have of the Native Americans at all.
Nothing like that. Now, who are those people? They're obviously, the style of clothing alone, if you were to look for, use a fashion designer to try and unsort this debacle, they would probably say, hey, somebody was there before them and took the Mediterranean garb and transferred it and had some sort of connection in the Caribbean to the clothing styles.
Did he speculate at all about where he thought this type of clothing had come from?
Nothing. I saw nothing in the letter that was a speculation about where they came from at all. And I had the impression in reading the rather extensive correspondence from Christopher Columbus back to Europe that he wasn't surprised at all that he was second or mm-hmm. third or tenth. In fact, the map that he used to come to the Americas, and you say, what? And Christopher Columbus had a map to come to the Americas? Well, we have a good copy of that map, but it's not like the map that we would normally use. The map we'd normally use of the world would be looking at the equator and everything branching out from an equatorial viewpoint. Mm-hmm. The map he had was a map from the North Pole looking down. And that was what was confusing to him, because it could not see very clearly the equatorial land masses, and he figured that there was some sort of passage into Cathay. And here's a couple of problems with that. First of all, is the fact that why would he think he could go to Cathay going west to begin with, and if he didn't figure he could get there, and he'd convince somebody that he could get there, that there was a passageway. And second of all, there were two reasons why Christopher Columbus came to the Americas. One of them, was headed toward Cathay. One was to execute merchant traffic, which had always been in effect for thousands of years before his time, and he knew that. And second of all, the other reason he came was to find the entrance to the Garden of Eden. Now, he said that. I didn't say that. He said that.
Yeah, and I've run across that before. But now let me ask you this. You know, his response to what he found when he got over here to the New World was initially he believed he had found his way to what we would say the East.
The South Indies, to India.
Yeah.
Which was fragmented colonies. And he figured he found himself to the South China Sea or into the islands off the coast of India.
And whenever you take into account the fact that he found people wearing button-down shirts and turbans and pants, you can understand why he thought he had made it there, because that is the way those folks dressed.
That's correct. And by the way, in some of the archaeological museums, we went to a very nice archaeological museum up the Mississippi River, and it shows the dress of the Native American Indian tribesmen. And they were wearing turbans, button-down shirts, and pants.
I have to confess that how the Native Americans dressed is not something that I've ever even really given much consideration to. And I guess I'm guilty of doing what lots of folks do, and that is we've all seen these, quote, Indians. And by the way, folks, don't write to me and tell me that I've been disrespectful. I'm part Native American myself, okay? I'm still going to tell you the truth about this. I guess I've always had the image that Hollywood has presented, and, you know, that's the way my ancestors in this country dressed. And, you know, you're telling me something here that I had not considered and did not know.
Here's something that you haven't considered and you don't know. In Mobile, Alabama, they still have a celebration. It's the celebration for the arrival of Prince Madoc, M-A-D-O-C.
Okay.
Prince Madoc was the brother of King Arthur. And by the way, Lewis and Clark, when they explored all the way out to the Columbia River in Washington State, were assigned a Welsh translator.
Why?
Why would the Lewis and Clark take a Welsh translator into the interior of North America with them? That's a good question. Okay.
Yeah.
And the other question is why would they continue that celebration in Mobile, Alabama every year? It's still a civic celebration. Why would Mount Tor, which is in Glastonbury, down in Wales in southern England, and it's carved out like a labyrinth, of like a maze, why would that exact maze symbol be on the Maricopa Indian, Native American Indian flag that they still fly out here in our neck of the woods? Why would they do that? And then why would, in the Spiltry Cathedral, on the frescoes drawn in 700 A.D., why would they have the death of King Arthur II being killed by Native American Indians with arrows? It was painted 700 years prior to Christopher Columbus.
Now, wait a minute. Let me get this straight. Where is this picture? Where is this fresco?
In England. At the Spiltry Cathedral. Still on the wall.
700 years before Christopher Columbus, there is a picture painted on the wall that shows the death of King Arthur.
King Arthur II, or Prince Madoc, his brother.
Prince Madoc. And he's being killed by Native Americans. How do we know they're Native Americans?
Well, first of all, it's Indian arrows. Second of all, it shows the Native tribes with the headdress of the tribes, though some of them are not totally in loincloths and bone vestments, done. But there's also a bunch of paintings in the Royal British Museum showing them carting the body of Prince Madoc back to Great Britain from a voyage to the West. And he's got Native American Indian arrows stuck in him. Now, why would that be in the Royal British Museum?
Well, it sounds as if we have simply not been told a whole lot of the pieces of history that I think are crucial. I think it's important. You know, we sort of talk about Christopher Columbus as being the one who, you know, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, and he discovered America. Well, of course, we know now that he did not, quote, discover America.
Did Erickson.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, you got to give Chris his due. I mean, he did find a whole lot of things about America, and, you know, he certainly popularized the place. But I think, you know, these are important pieces of our history.
And why would Lewis and Clark need a Welsh translator?
Yeah, that's a good question. Why?
Well, they used a Welsh translator, and they weren't the only ones that were required to take a Welsh translator with them, too. They're just ones that you'd know about, and we can talk about, because Lewis and Clark are credited for discovering the Western United States. But they took a Welsh translator with them because some of the Native American Indian tribes spoke Welsh. In other words, why in the world would Native American Indian tribes be speaking Welsh at the time of Lewis and Clark?
Quite obviously because they had been exposed to Welsh speakers.
They were obviously speaking Welsh.
Uh-huh. So who would that have been? Who would have been the Welsh-speaking Madoc?
Probably had a lot to do with Prince Madoc. Prince Madoc was over here. You know, King Arthur said in his own documents that he left that his treasure land was to the west, and he was standing on Mount Tor. And if you ever been stood on Mount Tor and looked west, you see ocean.
All right. So is America? Is this the Americas? Is this Avalon?
More than likely. we could go over 10,000 different little tiny vignettes that I have discovered over the years, well beyond the scope of the radio program. But the fact remains is that we have now defined in our day the reality of what America really is, and we've discounted the Native American Indian contribution, reality of the Americas. And that is a tragedy. And you have to ask yourself, why have we done that? Well, maybe it's beyond our weirdometer, or maybe that's your rationale. But I think it's even more perverted than that. I think that Christopher Columbus came here, stuck a flag in the dirt, and said, mine, mine, mine.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to talk about that maybe he came over here and actually stole. And
I think it's pretty self-evident that that is what happened. And I know there are people that will disagree with that. But, you know, the Native American population that was here was anything but barbaric. As some of their practices based on the European sensitivities may have seemed barbaric. But they were not. They had a well-developed civilization. Each of the tribes, well-developed civilization, well-developed.
Some of them had been degenerated too into cannibalism. Some of them had degenerated into loincloth-bearing tribal people that had retrograded or devolved, so to speak.
Well, even so, but I mean, look. Just think about this. Now, you and I are sitting out here in the Phoenix, Arizona area. And when it's 120 degrees outside, I don't care if you're going to work in an office. You're not going to wear a suit and tie. If you have to go to work in an office you're not going to that office in a suit and tie because it's too hot. And you don't want to have a heat stroke. And so the way we dress, and I have been to lots of offices where I have seen I've seen office workers in really nice offices wearing shorts. It's hot out here. So someone back east that is used to working in skyscrapers and it's always nice moderate weather and so forth, and they're used to wearing the suit and tie, would look at us and say, man, these people are not cultured. That's not it. It's that we know how to survive in this heat, and to survive in this heat, you can't wear the suit and tie when it's 120 degrees outside.
Well, that's true.
And so you have the same thing with the Native Americans. In some parts of the country, for instance here, I'm sure they were really dressed down, you know, for survival.
Well, there's no doubt about it, and we know that the Toltec Empire, which ruled Mesoamerica, was a trading society.
Mm-hmm.
And you ask yourself, who did they do the trade with? Well, we know who they did the trade with because by the time of the Toltec Empire, the drug traffic between Europe and the Middle East and the Americas was well established by then.
The drug traffic?
The drug traffic.
Okay.
Yeah. We know, for example, that of the pyramids, mummies that were in Egypt,
They
have done toxicology reports on their hair, on the mummies that are the nine German mummies that are in the German museums to this very day.
Yeah.
All of them had cocaine in their hair. All of them. Now you don't grow cocaine in the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
You don't grow it in Africa. You don't grow it in Russia, you grow it in the Andes. And They also had mummified in their stomachs tobacco. Tobacco was grown in one place. It wasn't grown in the Mediterranean. It wasn't grown in Africa. It was grown in the Americas. This drug traffic was well established by the time of the building of the pyramids. And the Toltecs came long after that, but nevertheless, the Toltecs were a trading empire. Some of the new pyramidal structures down in Chile They were expecting to find big walls to protect them from other kinds of tribal lords, etc., etc. But they happened to stumble across in these desert Chilean communities, these pyramidal structures that have absolutely no defensive systems at all. They have no arrowheads. They have no spearheads. These cities sitting there on the Chilean coast were largely merchant societies. And who did they do merchant traffic with?
Well, Europe and the Near or Mid East. Hey, we're into a break. And, folks, let me say this. We're going to have to end our conversation with Glenn because of that telephone situation I told you about last night. But, Glenn, I want to thank you for being with us. I want you to come back and be with us again real soon. I've got to get into some more of this. This is fascinating.
Well, we got to get into Ireland and Portugal and the Exodus.
We'll do that next time you're with us. If you will, stay on the line with me for just a minute. And, folks, well, let's see. Here we go. There we go. All right, we'll be back right after this break. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and we have opened up the telephone line for you. I want to thank Glenn for being with us this evening. He's always fascinating. I mean, some of those facts, some of those little factoids, little bits of information that he shared with us, I had never heard before. Now, maybe you have. I don't know. But the telephone line is open if you would like to call. The telephone number is 623-237-3814. 623-237-3814 if you would like to call in, if you have a comment or a question. Let me tell you this, just to sort of, so we're all kind of thinking together about, we understand what's the deal here with the telephones. We use Magic Jack. You've seen it advertised on television. It's a fabulous system. And each of our telephone lines are Magic Jack. Well, the incoming telephone, Magic Jack, has malfunctioned. And so a new one has been ordered. It's on the way. You do need to know this. Now, I recommend Magic Jack. I think it's a fabulous system. And some of you have gotten a Magic Jack as a result of you've heard me talk about it. And I don't get paid to advertise Magic Jack. I just that's what we use. And I've got to tell you, and you make up your own mind about this. I have to tell you, if you have a Magic Jack that malfunctions and you need it replaced, their policy is, well, you go ahead and buy another one, and then we'll issue you a credit for the price of that other one, but you have to buy another one now, okay? All right, we have a call coming in, so let's do this. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, this is Trey in Atlanta.
Yeah, Trey.
Yeah, Kevin, I want to ask you a question. I know you're a lot of history and stuff.
All right.
And it's something I learned about in the last 2 years. I'd never heard of them. It was a group of humans that were here before Columbus and all the boats came over, and they have a website and list all the last names of the different people who are related to them, and they're called Melungeons. You ever heard of Melungeons?
I have, and then after telling you that I have heard of them, I will have to confess that I know nothing about them, other than, yes, I have heard of that.
Well, they looked them up, and they're all names who were not French or not British, but were similar, and they were lived in the mountains because they were outnumbered by the American Indian. And so they pretty much had to go up there and just live on the mountains. And that's basically where you get mountain men from.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure who they're related to. I don't think they know for sure. But, you know, a lot of the stories, and I think we found out through your real-life of Indiana Jones guy that you called that, the Stargate guy over there. He said,
talking about Jerry Wills?
Yeah, well, yeah, Jerry Wills talked about that one of the stories. He was over there in that mountain village that talked about really tall, red-haired men and women.
Well, blonde hair.
Yeah, blonde hair, and he was talking about possible Vikings. And so you figure the old Vikings in the old days, all the conquering and stuff they did, well, you figure there's probably Vikings on most every continent. If they went there to conquer, there's some that got left behind or something. So there's a chance that there was leftover Vikings here also, you know.
Well, yeah, that's a possibility. But let me ask you this. Do you think that the Melungeons were Viking?
Kevin, there's a very good chance, but, I mean, I don't know for sure. I can tell you this, that it all makes sense because I'm one of them, the Melungeons. And,
how do you know that?
I can tell you this, I'm really, really hot-natured. I love it when it's cold. So,
how do you know that you're a Melungeon?
Because my last name was on the list. There's two last names that are similar to mine. One of them was French, one of them was British. And my uncle found this out from a professional guy who traced back all these names and stuff. And he said,
"So
ours isn't French or English."
And so where do the Melungeons come from?
Told me one night about the website, and I thought he was joking. I was like, "Melungeon, what's that?" And I went there, and there was her last name on that. Well, and there's a list of them. One of the names is Cook, C-O-O-K, Kennedy. And
okay.
There's
Trey, time out. Where do Melungeons come from?
I don't know. It doesn't say that they know for sure, Kevin, that I've ever heard.
So are they Europeans?
Well, yeah, that's what we're assuming, since, you know, the skin color and everything. I mean, but, you know, I haven't found any website that says specifically this is where they came from genetically and all that stuff. But you know. I just don't know. We don't know all the history of the Americas. We just don't know who was here before us, really, and we could find bones and caves and stuff, but, I mean, Kevin, it's hard to figure all this stuff out exactly. I don't know how they would know, unless they found documents or historical dating, do you?
No, but let me throw this out. The prevailing theory about the population, how the Americas got populated, is that some nomadic people from Siberia crossed over a land bridge into what is now Alaska and worked their way down, and as the tribes grew, they fanned out across America. That being the case, the oldest so-called Native American civilizations here in the Americas should be in Alaska, but they're not. They're in South America. How did that happen?
See, that's what I'm saying, Kevin. There's so many, you know, things we don't know about exactly. We find out we're wrong about this, or we're wrong about this date or that fact. So, no, that's a great question. I just, you know, never heard of him, and my uncle told me about it, and I thought he was making it up, and I found it on the website, so I go, I guess you're not.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check that out. I'm going to find out where you came from.
Okay, so anyway, you can find out, tell me, because all I know is I like it when it's cold, and I hate it when it's hot.
Well, you probably came from Norway or someplace like that.
Okay, appreciate it. Taking my call.
All right, thanks for the call. All right, folks, the telephone line is open, and the telephone number is 623-237-3814. 623-237-3814. Fascinating stuff. When you start to think about where did we come from? Now, I'm not talking about this whole theory of, you know, that we are hybridized or genetically engineered by aliens. I mean, that's a theory, but that's talking about where the human race came from. That's a theory that's out there, and we've discussed it. We've discussed some other possible origins for the human race, but I'm not talking about the origins of the human race. I'm talking about the folks who live right here in the Americas. And that goes all the way from the very tip-top of Canada to the very tip-bottom of South America, the folks that were populating all of this area. And, you know, where did they come from? And I think it's a really fascinating thing for us to study and to find out about. One of the things that's really interesting, when you get into looking at the ancient tribes like Toltec and the Olmec, now, their carvings are pretty interesting because some of the they have some big carvings of you know, heads. I guess heads of figures of their kings, or maybe of their gods. Some of those have black African features. Some of them have what we would say are very Asian, and I would say Chinese features. You know, when you talk about Asian, you're talking about India, you're talking about Thailand, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia. But I'm not talking about just Asian. They had very Chinese-looking features. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Hello, caller.
Hi, Kevin. This is Debbie from Columbus.
Hi. How are you doing, Debbie?
I'm pretty good. We got hit by a bike really bad. I can't get through on my line, so I'm having to call you on my cell phone.
Okay. We can hear you.
Okay, great. Thanks for having Glenn on. He's really interesting. It's really interesting that he came through with these documents about Christopher Columbus. These are things many of us don't, you know, have a clue about, considering what we learned about him in school.
Did you know that that little factoid he dropped on us about Christopher Columbus describing the way the people were dressed, the natives? They were dressed in button-down shirts and wearing turbans and pants. Did you know that about Native Americans? Had you ever heard that?
Well, no, I knew that about Native Americans, but not that Christopher Columbus had mentioned anything mm-hmm. like that in his letters to Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand. That type of dress is actually the Seminole people of southern Florida dress like that, and also some of the Cherokee tribes in North Carolina dress like that, too.
Well, that's interesting. See, I had never heard that, and I'm part Cherokee.
Have you ever seen the picture of Sequoia? There's like a, I think it's like a either an ink drawing or like a linotype or something like that. And he's dressed almost similarly as what Glenn was talking about.
Yeah, I can't say that I have seen that, but maybe I have. I'm an old guy. I forget stuff.
Well, you do know who Sequoia is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but I don't think I've ever seen this drawing that you're talking about.
In it, he's basically just sitting down. He has a pipe, and then he's writing on parchment the Cherokee alphabet.
I'll have to see if I can find that on the internet. I don't recall it.
I'm not sure exactly where I saw it. I mean, I think I saw it in a history book or something about Native American tribes, but it's really interesting. And he actually has almost like a turban-type wrapping on his head, and his shirt has actual buttons on it. I mean, these aren't like, you know, like bits of shell or anything like that. These are actual buttons.
Well, I'm going to look it up. I was a little amazed by that. But, you know, having said that, I say again, that may be why Christopher Columbus thought he had made it all the way to India, because of the dress, the way they were dressed.
That's a good possibility, but yeah. Of course, even at that time, you know, Europe was still sort of coming out of the Dark Ages. You know, they were almost, you know, in the beginning of the Renaissance and coming out of the Dark Ages, so a whole lot of the whole world, the New World at that time, there was really not a whole lot known about it.
Debbie, thanks for the call. I'm into a break, and I do appreciate the call so much. Thanks. Have a good evening. All right, folks, we will be back right after this break, so don't go away and get your fingers ready to do that dialing. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I am your host, Kevin Smith, and we've been talking earlier with Glenn Kimball, a fascinating, fascinating mind. He always brings interesting information. It is controversial information, But I have discovered, after 8 years in this business, that there's not anything you can say that someone will not take exception to. Anything you say, I don't care what it is, there are people looking for a reason to object and to take exception. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, especially if you're in this business, which is, of course, talk shows. He's kind of ignited a real interest for me because I am part Cherokee. And here we've heard that we've got Native Americans wearing button-down shirts and pants and turbans. Christopher Columbus wrote about it in his report back to the King and Queen of Spain. And that interests me. I didn't know that about Native American dress. Pardon me while I enjoy a little bit of coffee. We've had some pretty big dust storms out here fairly recently. And since the dust storms, you probably have seen them on your television. If you watch weather, if you watch the Weather Channel, you've probably seen some video of some of the dust storms we've had. But, I didn't know that about the Native Americans. The telephone line is open. It's 623-237-3814. 623-237-3814. Whenever we bring up topics like Glenn has brought up, and believe me, Glenn's been with us before, and he has said some things and presented some information that is far more controversial than these things that he's talked to us about tonight. But in this report, and maybe I'm wrong about this. I mean, if I'm wrong about this, you let me know, all right? Or maybe you agree with it. But here you've got Christopher Columbus, who reports back to the king and queen and says to them, I found this new land. I found a way into this new, or a new way into the East. And people responded to that in Europe, and they came this direction. If we're going to believe what Chris said about this new world, maybe I'm wrong, but I think we ought to believe, not necessarily believe, but I think we ought to accept as fact what he wrote about seeing that Bigfoot. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. It's Terry from Ohio.
Hi, Terry.
Hey, I don't know if you heard about the mounds we have here in Ohio, and I think goes over to Illinois.
The mountains?
Yeah. They are supposedly, legend is that the Indians, when they relocated here, they found some giant red-haired people living in this area, and supposedly it's what these mounds are, where they buried them.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. And as a matter of fact, there is a state park where there used to be a, they unearthed the some mummies. And they were very, very tall, like you're talking about. They had red hair. That was excavated. And the remains are apparently gone. Nobody knows where they went to.
Yeah, it's something that's it's kind of downplayed, but I've heard about it, and that the Indians here, that they were cannibals and they had to kill them off and chase them out of here.
Now you're saying not the Indians were not cannibals. It was these tall, red-haired beings.
Right, correct.
Yeah.
And the Indians that were kind of trying to locate here, they were killing them and eating them and stuff, so they had to kill them off and chase them off, from what I understand. I don't have the whole story, but it sounds like, there's a lot more to America than meets the eye.
Yeah, I read a story. I did a show on these mound builders and it was about 3 years ago. And I'm trying to remember some of the things that I read at that time. And one of the stories I read was during the late 1800s, one of these very tall creatures sauntered into a town, walked down Main Street, and everybody saw it. And I think it just walked on, and nobody killed it or whatever. But it was the late 1800s, and he walked into a town there.
Yeah, I just know that there's Indian legends, and they used to live in caves and stuff, I guess. And there's one story up here where they, stacked a bunch of wood in front of the cave where they were at, where a lot of their bones and mummies were found, lit it on fire and, called them to come out or they're going to die, and none of them ever came out. It's one of the legends. So I don't know exactly where that was at. But
I read that story, too. So what do you think? Was it Bigfoot, or were these just very tall humans, giants?
I believe in, giants in the past, and, that seed line, I think there's probably got to be something to do with that.
Well, what do you think about Bigfoot? Is that real?
Well, I've never seen one, Kevin, so I couldn't really say,
What do you think about Christopher Columbus saying that he saw one?
Pardon me?
What do you think about Christopher Columbus writing to the king and queen of Spain and describing one and describing that how he saw it killed and that the natives chopped it up and took it away for food?
If there's documentation, of that, and you can prove that it's his handwriting and from his, from that era, I'd have to give it credibility.
Well, I wish I had asked about that. I didn't think to ask about that. And that's one of the problems of not having multiple phone lines available to us right now. Because I know there are folks out there that would have thought of that and would have called in with that question. And we're on the way to full repair, so we're just awaiting parts now. Terry, thank you.
Oh, you're doing a good job, Kevin.
I'm sorry?
Bye.
Bye. All right. I'm not sure what he said. I talked on the top of him there. But ladies and gentlemen, the telephone line is open. The telephone number is 623-237-3814 if you have a question or if you have a comment about what we're talking about tonight. The real history of our country, I'm not talking about the history of our government, but the history of the country, of this continent, the history that took place long before any of our ancestors arrived, is fascinating. Are you aware of the fact that these civilizations down in Central and South America, for instance, the Aztec, there are historians and archaeologists that have written that civilization rivaled the civilization of Rome in its sophistication? Are you aware of the fact that the Inca, the Aztec, and even the Mayan, and I say that because that was an older civilization, architecturally were as advanced as the Romans? Fascinating stuff. All right, we've reached the end of this show. We've got another great show planned for you for tomorrow night. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you'd like to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until tomorrow, so long, everybody.